Early in the morning, the king rose and took his army by a forced march along the road to Beth Zachariah, and his troops made ready for battle and sounded their trumpets. They showed the elephants the juice of grapes and mulberries to arouse them for battle. And upon the elephants were wooden towers, strong and covered. They were fastened upon each beast by special harness, and upon each were four armed men who fought from there, and also its Indian driver. Welcome to 15 Minute Maccabees Episode 6, Against the Elephants. I'm Mayor Soloveitchik. Let us, on Chanukah, suddenly speak of Sukkot. Sarah Josepha Hale, the woman who lobbied several presidents for a national American annual Thanksgiving holiday, argued that such a day would parallel what she called the yearly season of Thanksgiving with the Jews. The reference, of course, was to Sukkot, a harvest Thanksgiving festival. But whereas Sukkot in the Bible is marked in the early fall, that is because it is in sync with Middle Eastern seasons. Whereas American Thanksgiving is what we might call Sukkot in November. But this itself has a certain precedent, because rightly understood, the original Chanukah was Sukkot in December. As we noted yesterday, on the occasion of Judah's purification and inauguration of the altar in Jerusalem, a celebration was held for 8 days. As the Talmud tells us, among the many miracles of the moment was that of a flask of oil that lasted longer than expected, but that miracle would only become central to the celebration and commemoration later, when the temple itself would be remembered by the kindling of lamps in Jewish homes. But, as the second book of Maccabees tells us, originally the celebration was 8 days, at least in part because it was meant to parallel the original biblical Thanksgiving holiday of Sukkot, which, including the last day known as Shmini Atzeret, is 8 days long. The second book of Maccabees tells us, quote, "Now Maccabeus and his followers, the Lord leading them on, recovered the temple and the city. And they tore down the altars which had been built in the public square by the foreigners and also destroyed the sacred precincts. They purified the sanctuary and made another altar of sacrifice. Then, striking fire out of flint, they offered sacrifices after a lapse of 2 years. And they burned incense and lighted lamps and set out the bread of the presence. And when they had done this, they fell prostrate and besought the Lord that they might never again fall into such misfortunes, but that if they should ever sin, they might be disciplined by him with forbearance and not be handed over to blasphemous and barbarous nations. It happened that on the same day on which the sanctuary had been profaned by the foreigners, the purification of the sanctuary took place, that is, on the 25th day of the same month, which was Kislev. And they celebrated it for 8 days with rejoicing, in the manner of the Feast of Booths, remembering how not long before, during the Feast of Booths, they had been wandering in the mountains and caves like wild animals. Therefore, bearing ivy-wreathed wands and beautiful branches and also fronds of palm, they offered hymns of thanksgiving to him who had given success to the purifying of his own holy place. They decreed by public ordinance and vote that the whole nation of the Jews should observe these days every year." Thus, the Feast of Booths, Sukkot in December. This was Chanukah, a remembrance of the last biblical holiday that had been missed in the temple when it had been desecrated for so many months by the pagans. And there is, I think, a deeper meaning to this commemoration. As the Mishnah makes clear, Sukkot in the temple with its multitude of offerings marked a celebration of the altar and its place in Jewish religious life. Pilgrims for the holiday would circle the altar in the temple courtyard, holding their palm fronds aloft, exactly as Sukkot in December is depicted in Maccabees. There is, of course, another aspect to the biblical celebration of the early fall festival known as Sukkot, and that, of course, is the observance that gives the holiday its name, sitting in a sukkah, dwelling during the holiday in a humble hut, unsheltered by impressive edifices, which is meant to remind Jews how all that we have, all that we achieve, is by the grace of God. There is no evidence that the huts were also an aspect of the Sukkot celebrated in December, but the second book of Maccabees does begin with a request to the Jewish diaspora, which reads, "And now see that you keep the Feast of Booths in the month of Kislev." This does not necessarily mean that there was any Sukkah element to the observance, but the name itself is significant, especially considering that after this holiday was marked, meaning after the temple was first dedicated by Judah, the man known as Maccabee would go from marking a holiday that paralleled one named for humble huts to battling forces wielding tall towers atop powerful pachyderms, allowing us to understand another important element of Judah's story and of Jewish history. We have discussed how Judah's entry into the temple took place when Antiochus IV had traveled to Persia, leaving Lysias in charge of the government and the king's young heir, Antiochus. But Judah's victories and his cleansing of the temple did not mean that Jerusalem was utterly independent or that the Hellenists had been utterly routed. The Seleucid army and the Jews allied with them still held the fortress inside Jerusalem itself. And as Antiochus IV died in Persia, Judah's constant attempts to conquer the fortress led to the young Antiochus V ordering another assault. This is 1 Maccabees chapter 6, describing the Hellenists complaining to Antiochus V. But some of the garrison escaped from the siege, and some of the ungodly Israelites joined them. They went to the king and said, "How long will you fail to do justice and to avenge our brethren? We were happy to serve your father, to live by what he said and to follow his commands. For this reason, the sons of our people besieged the citadel and became hostile to us. Moreover, they have put to death as many of us as they have caught, and they have seized our inheritances. And not against us alone have they stretched out their hands, but also against all the lands on their borders. And behold, today they have encamped against the citadel in Jerusalem to take it. They have fortified both the sanctuary and Beth-Sur, and unless you quickly prevent them, they will do greater things, and you will not be able to stop them." The king was enraged when he heard this. He assembled all his friends, the commanders of his forces, and those in authority. And mercenary forces came to him from other kingdoms and from islands of the seas. The number of his forces was 100,000 foot soldiers, 20,000 horsemen, and 32 elephants, accustomed to war. End quote. Thus, the first book of Maccabees describes the Seleucid assault on Judea, telling us how elephants were introduced into battle against the Jews, with one of the most famous engagements in Maccabean history unfolding in the Battle of Beth Zachariah. The drama described in the text is worth reading, known especially for the first death of one of the members of the Hasmonean family, Judah's brother, known as Eliezer. Quote, "Early in the morning, the king rose and took his army by a forced march along the road to Beth Zachariah, and his troops made ready for battle and sounded their trumpets. They showed the elephants the juice of grapes and mulberries to arouse them for battle. And they distributed the beasts among the phalanxes. With each elephant, they stationed 1,000 men armed with coats of mail and with brass helmets on their heads. And 500 picked horsemen were assigned to each beast. These took their position beforehand, and wherever the beast was, wherever it went, they went with it, and they never left it. And upon the elephants were wooden towers, strong and covered. They were fastened upon each beast by special harness, and upon each were 4 armed men who fought from there, and also its Indian driver. The rest of the horsemen were stationed on either side, on the 2 flanks of the army, to harass the enemy while being themselves protected by the phalanxes. When the sun shone upon the shields of gold and brass, the hills were ablaze with them and gleamed like flaming torches. Now, a part of the king's army was spread out on the high hills, and some troops were on the plain, and they advanced steadily and in good order. All who heard the noise made by their multitude, by the marching of the multitude and the clanking of their arms, trembled, for the army was very large and strong. But Judah and his army advanced to the battle, and 600 men of the king's army fell. And Eliezer, called Avaron, saw that one of the beasts was equipped with royal armor. It was taller than all the others, and he supposed that the king was upon it. So he gave his life to save his people and to win for himself an everlasting name. He courageously ran into the midst of the phalanx to reach it. He killed men right and left, and they parted before him on both sides. He got under the elephant, stabbed it from beneath, and killed it. But it fell to the ground upon him, and there he died. And when the Jews saw the royal might and the fierce attack of the forces, they turned away in flight." End quote. This was Judah's first defeat, and the first death in battle of one of the men known today as the Maccabees. In Josephus' description of the moment, he describes the death of Eliezer as a vain seeking of glory. But the earlier text, which I have just cited, emphasizes that Eliezer, believing that the young king sat upon the elephant crowned with the tallest tower, thought that risking or even sacrificing his life under the elephant would be a way in which the battle could be won on behalf of the traditional Jews, as indeed it surely might have been had Antiochus V actually been astride the elephant. Eliezer's daring should be seen as an act of inspiring bravery and heroism. On the one hand, this defeat was a severe setback for Judah. Antiochus V was not struck in battle, and as Maccabees tells us, he then headed for Jerusalem. Quote, "There he encamped before the sanctuary for many days. He set up siege towers, engines of war to throw fire and stones, machines to shoot arrows and catapults. The Jews also made engines of war to match theirs and fought for many days. But they had no food in storage, because it was the 7th year. Those who found safety in Judea from the Gentiles had consumed the last of the stores. Few men were left in the sanctuary, because famine had prevailed over the rest, and they had been scattered each to his place." End quote. Thus, because it was the year known as Shemitah, when the land lies fallow, there was no food in storage, and Judah's forces were in desperate straits. Ultimately, it was politics that proved a temporary salvation for the Maccabees. Lysias, the guardian of the young king Antiochus V, learns that another man named Philip had been named by Antiochus IV prior to the king's death to serve as the official guardian of Antiochus V. And so Lysias headed back to Antioch to stave off the challenge to his own power. Though a temporary truce was negotiated with the traditional Jews of Jerusalem, the truce was immediately violated by the Seleucids, who, according to the book of Maccabees, tore down the walls atop Mount Zion in Jerusalem before departing. More battles were yet to come. But despite the defeat, children learning about the story never fail to remember the tale of the elephant that collapses through the stab devastatingly delivered by Eliezer. It is one of the few elements outside the specific story of the dedication of the temple that is known by many. And the point, perhaps, is that the elephant that collapses while containing the tallest tower of all seems to us psychologically, poetically, to embody the enemy empire itself, a towering colossus that a properly placed blow ultimately brings down. The most famous military maneuver involving elephants is Hannibal's crossing of the Alps with the Carthaginian army, with his elephants along for the ride. Most artistic depictions had emphasized Hannibal's heroism and the grandeur of his assault, with the general and his men astride elephants towering over their troops. But, as I described in an episode of Jerusalem 365, in 1812, the British artist Turner made a sensation with his depiction of Hannibal crossing the Alps, utilizing a visual inversion, giving an elephant at the center of the scene, but one so tiny you had to squint to see it, so that in the landscape, the gargantuan beast is rendered as if it was nothing by the towering might of the mountains and the swirling snow surrounding the pachyderm. Turner, in other words, reminds us that even the might of an elephant is terrifically tiny in God's world. With this moment in art history in mind, we can, as I have previously suggested, ponder how one tiny people endured and how even gargantuan empires, with all its elephants, could not overcome it. It's therefore striking to think not only of the elephant, but of the Seleucid Tower atop it, one all the more interesting because of the link between Sukkot and the Maccabee story. On Sukkot, the Haftarah, or prophetic portion read in synagogues, is Ezekiel's apocalyptic vision of the Battle of Gog and Magog. The prophet describes an international axis of nations that sets out to destroy the Jews, an axis whose ultimate defeat will be marked, according to Zechariah, by the celebration of Sukkot. As I described in an article and commentary, this mysterious prophecy was brilliantly explained by Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. The ancient tale of the Tower of Babel, Rabbi Hirsch wrote, describes a pagan tyrannical society that created an edifice in worship of its own power. It is just such nations that hate the Jews who preach a God of morality and justice. By celebrating Sukkot in what seems to be a mere shack, Jews, Rabbi Hirsch argued, signify their certainty that the ethos marked by the Tower of Babel will be ultimately undone in the unfolding of the history of the world. The people who suffered most at the hands of tyranny confidently predict, to paraphrase Rabbi Hirsch, that world history, which began with a totalitarian tower, will end in a holiday of huts, a defeat of evil and a recognition of God as the true source of power and justice. With this in mind, celebrating now the 8 days of Hanukkah that were inspired by Sukkot, we can see in the story of the collapse of the elephant a sign of more Maccabee victory still in store, with Judah's greatest victory yet to come. That victory, one that is profoundly relevant to Israel in our own time, will be discussed in tomorrow's episode as we continue to mark our Sukkot in December. This is Meir Soloveitchik wishing you a luminous and meaningful Hanukkah. Signing off.